Welcome to the Butte Report. It is Thursday, December 10th, 2020. The Butte Report is a weekly program reporting on and analyzing issues that affect our lives and our livelihood by focusing on local government, including the Board of Supervisors, the various municipalities, and even school districts and water districts within Butte County. I'm your host, Sue Hildebrand. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Square Deal Mattress Factory, building the best night's sleep since 1920. Square Deal is celebrating their 100th anniversary of making mattresses, bedding, furniture, and now face masks with fabric of your choice. Square Deal is located at 1354 Humboldt Avenue in Chico. For more details, see squaredealmattress.com. Tonight we'll cover the Gridley City Council, the Butte County Board of Supervisors, and the Chico City Council. We'll also hear from Butte County Supervisor Deborah Lucero, Chico's Homeless Solutions Coordinator Susie Kokums, and Chico Unified School Board Member-elect Caitlin Dalby. At the Gridley City Council meeting this past Monday, the newest members of the council were sworn in, including Michael Farr, Catalina Sanchez, and Angel Calderon. The outgoing members were honored, including Raymond Borges, Chris Williams, and Quentin Cry. Mayor Bruce Johnson was reconfirmed as mayor by the incoming council, and Michael Farr was voted in as vice mayor. The new council approved a resolution adopting the amended Housing Rehabilitation Program Guidelines and the First Time Home Buyers Program Guidelines. On Tuesday, the Butte County Board of Supervisors held their regular meeting with two issues of particular interest, one being an update from the county's state and federal lobbyists, and the other a discussion about how the county would use the $205 million from the PG&E Camp Fire settlement. Starting with the legislative update, each year the Board of Supervisors establishes priorities with regard to state and federal legislation. The draft platforms for 2021 were prepared in consultation with county department heads, input from the board members, and the county's state and federal lobbyists. The county's legislative priorities include issues such as public safety, health and human services, water, public infrastructure, and local government finances and general government. To talk about a few of these legislative priorities, I spoke with Supervisor Deborah Lucero and started by asking her what were the most interesting aspects of the upcoming legislative platform.
The most interesting aspect yesterday to me was the idea that for the first time in our nation's history, there is a bond being proposed and it's going to be coming out of California to close the digital divide in our state. COVID, as we all know, has brought to the surface the inequity of many of these situations, and broadband is one of them. We have children who are unable to get online to do their classroom work. We have workers who are unable to work from home when they have to work from home simply because they don't have access. And while many people think this is just a rural issue, it is also an issue in urban centers. There are places within many urban cities that people of color do not have internet access. So while most of our homes in America, I think the percentage is something like 98% have telephones, and the percentage goes way down when you come to broadband and internet. And it can't be just the dial-up kind of internet. We need high-speed internet to all the homes in America if we are going to compete economically, if we are going to compete educationally, if we are going to provide equitable education to people and job opportunities. We have to have that for all of our citizens. And as we know, up here in the North State, it's a challenge.
Supervisor Lucero, well, let's talk about that particular issue. As you all were updated in your meeting the other day, there is federal funding that is being discussed right now around COVID and how that money would make its way to California and then, of course, down to the counties. What did you learn?
Well, we learned that it's a real hot potato. Apparently, the White House waded into these discussions today, and they want a lower payment, weekly unemployment payment, than is being proposed in the $908 billion package. People have come together on the Hill that are on both sides of the aisle that that prepared this package, and now the White House is coming out with another one, I hear, today. But basically, it would mean about $160 billion approximately going to local governments. That would be money that would get pushed down to counties, of which there are over 3,000 counties in the United States. And in our state, of course, there are 58. The last time COVID funding came down the pike, communities under $500,000 did not get directly funded. So if you were a city or if you were a county that did not have $500,000, you did not receive direct funds. So that was different here in California, where California did push out funding to all of its counties. And they use a formula that is used in other programs to figure out what that cost or that benefit would be to each county. So they're trying to get basically the federal government to look at a similar funding mechanism so that local governments are not left out. Most counties across the country right now are on the forefront of the COVID disaster, the pandemic. We are the ones in public health who are dealing with all of the questions, trying to understand what it's going to mean when a vaccine comes available, how that will be dispersed. It's a huge job. And really, truthfully, many of our frontline workers are beginning to be burned out. Even though COVID is our latest disaster, you know, here in Butte County, I mean, it's hard to remember all these things, but 2017, we had the Oroville Dam spillway crisis. Then in 2018, we had the Camp Fire. Then in 2019, we had flooding, and that was worse than ever just simply because of the fires. And then in 2020, we had the North Complex Fire and COVID. So as a county agency, our workers, our employees, our frontline folks have not had a break. And it's showing. And then on top of that, you have such divisive environment where people are being called into question for simply being professional and doing their jobs.
Supervisor Lucero, you brought up the campfire, and that was another interesting discussion that you all had at the meeting the other day. The CAO, Andy Pickett, brought to you all a sort of the beginning of this proposal of how the almost $5 million that came from PG&E in the settlement for the campfire. He brought that to you for a discussion, basically the policies of how that money might be used at the county level. So talk about some of the more interesting ways that Andy Pickett was suggesting that the board think about this money.
Well, this discussion came out of an earlier discussion that we had had in July about what we were going to do with the $205 million. There was actually a $252 million settlement from PG&E after the campfire, but after the lawyer's fees and all that, it came out to be about $205 million. And in that meeting in July, we all discussed going forward, what would this look like? What should be the reason behind basically awarding any kind of money out of the PG&E fund? You know, what kind of policies should guide that? So Andy did come up with some policies. The staff came up with some policies. And immediately what was thought is that we need to backfill the property tax. So they proposed a 10-year backfill, which would basically add up to about $22 million. It would be $4 million for the following fiscal year, and then they would reduce it by $400,000 annually, also increasing the general fund reserve by $8 million to get it up to what is actually suggested in our code to have 16, or in our policies, rather, to have $16 million as a reserve fund, which is very important. We've learned that in these disasters. We've spent, I think, $6 million out of our reserve fund just in the last 2 years. We also talked about $5 million set aside for an audit, because FEMA is infamous for coming back on local governments and saying, oh, by the way, you didn't fill this out right, or you allocated this money and you can't really allocate that money, and you can be hit years later with fines and findings is what they call them. And then there's a $900,000 loan on the Bangor Fire Station. And to pay that debt off would save us a tremendous amount of interest. One thing I failed to mention about the PG&E settlement that I found very interesting and exciting, that was establishing an office. Now, they called it kind of a more expansive Office of Emergency Services. And when I came into office, I started talking about an Office of Resiliency, and I don't know if you might remember that, but I really thought it would be great to establish an Office of Resiliency and Recovery that could be looking at how to make our county more resilient and our citizens more resilient. And that would not just be from an emergency perspective, but from a health perspective, from a food perspective. You know, when you have people that are food insecure, we have so many different types of crises. We still have food trucks that are coming here every week from Contra Costa County and Solano to feed our people because there's still that much hunger here. So we have a lot of things to take care of in this county, and I encourage citizens to learn more. We all have to start working together because these problems are bigger than just one county. We need to begin to look more regionally, and that was something I ran on a couple of years ago. I ran on regionalism, and I believe in it because we have small counties here, and we need to work together on large problems, problems like homelessness, problems like mental health issues, behavioral health issues, and we're not going to be able to solve it on our own. It's going to take more than a village. It's going to take a region.
That was Butte County Supervisor Deborah Lucero. When we return, we'll talk about the Chico City Council meeting and hear from Chico's Homeless Solutions Coordinator, Susie Cockhams. You're listening to the Butte Report on KZFR 90.1 FM in Chico. At the Chico City Council meeting on Tuesday night, the three outgoing members of the council were honored for their service, including council members Carl Ory, Randall Stone, and Ann Schwab. Three new members were sworn in, Andrew Coolidge, Cammie Denley, and Topeka Tandon. Returning to the council after winning re-election was Sean Morgan. Following the swearing-in, the new council elected Andrew Coolidge to be the next mayor and Casey Reynolds as vice mayor. The next order of business was the adoption of an emergency ordinance by a 5-2 margin. This ordinance allows for additional enforcement tools to address existing rules and regulations in Bidwell Park and other parks and playgrounds. These tools including issuing misdemeanors or infractions, and the existing rules include camping. In a separate agenda item, city staff gave an update on efforts to address Chico's homeless crisis and reported that there are still no low-barrier winter shelters and no sanctioned campgrounds. To learn more about the passage of the emergency ordinance and how the lack of safe shelter will impact Chico's homeless community, I spoke with Susie Cockhams, Chico's Homeless Solutions Coordinator, and started by asking her to explain the emergency ordinance.
The City Council adopted the emergency ordinance, which allows for the enforcement of rules and regulations within Bidwell Park and other park areas and playgrounds as either misdemeanors or infractions. And this will allow for heightened enforcement of illegal behaviors within those public spaces, which amplifies the level of accountability and public expectation of safety, cleanliness, and environmental stewardship of those areas. Park rangers, code enforcement officers, police, and the target team, and my understanding, any other employee with enforcement powers will be part of that enforcement team.
Susie Cockhams, the reason that we are seeing people camping in parks is, for one, we have a real shortage of affordable housing, and then the pandemic hit, and the very real lack of legal camping spaces. And one of the things that council members Scott Huber and Alex Brown brought up is that there is no designated campground, and there's no low-barrier shelters in Chico. So how is the city staff preparing for the eventual movement of these folks that are currently camping in the parks? Maybe they move into the neighborhoods. How is the city preparing for that?
Well, those individuals or city staff that have those enforcement powers will be enforcing illegal activities wherever they happen. You know, it's a really unique environment that we have because of COVID. You know, I can't honestly answer how the city is preparing for the lack of emergency shelter beds, because this ordinance isn't directed at the homeless population. It's directed at illegal activities wherever they happen in our parks, park areas, and playgrounds. So there's plenty of areas across the city that are not parks and park areas and playgrounds. The real struggle that I'm having in our community is that, number one, everyone looks to the city to be the only problem solver, if you will, of the homeless population. And it's going to take all city residents, all city businesses, and the county all working in tandem to solve the problem. And then you add the layer of our service provider system to that. And we have a lack of capacity or bandwidth, if you will, with our service provider organizations. You know, we have one true emergency shelter provider, and that's the True North Housing Alliance and the Torres Shelter. Right now, we have the Jesus Center, who's kind of in a construction mode, and their renewal center will be opening in the spring. We have Safe Space Winter Shelter, who is trying desperately to find a location that has sprinklers so we can do some overnight sheltering when the weather gets, you know, cold enough to operate one on a continual basis. And they're struggling. You know, the city wants to work with service providers because the city itself is not a homeless service provider. But the city is really more of a funder and an advocate than the service provider network. So when we're talking about, you know, how many shelter beds are available and can we open a new shelter, we have to look at the capacity and bandwidth of what we have as nonprofits in our local continuum of care. And we lack the capacity. So right now, per our 2019 point in time count, we have approximately 400 unsheltered homeless that we counted in that count. We would need 400 beds to solve that problem. We do not have a service provider who has the capacity to tackle even 200 to 300 more people. So even if we had all the money in the world to solve the problem, we lack service provider capacity to do that.
You mentioned earlier that this emergency ordinance applies to everybody that is committing illegal activity, participating in some kind of illegal activity, but the only people that camp in the parks are people that are homeless. So it's kind of a funny comment to say that it's not directed at only homeless people, but only homeless people are camping in the parks. But we move on. Susie Cockums, you mentioned that people are looking to the city to address this problem, and that is because we really do have a lack of providers to address the problem. The city has not been able to identify a place for unhoused people to camp legally, and there is not a shelter space that is big enough to address the problem that we have. Talk about what are some of the challenges to the city to offer a winter shelter.
So our biggest challenge lately has been twofold. Number one, identifying a location is the fact that we have very little vacant space that have sprinklers. And our building codes are based on the California state building codes. And building codes say if you're going to provide overnight sleeping, then that facility or tent or opportunity has to have sprinklers. And in years past, Safe Space Winter Shelter has operated in churches without sprinklers, but the city was not made aware of those environments. And so that was allowed to happen. And thank God, you know, nothing bad happened. But when I connected Safe Space Winter Shelter to city staff, they were informed that moving forward, they needed to have sprinklers if they were going to shelter folks overnight. So that's been the task at hand, is to find a location. And again, Safe Space, the service provider, has been looking at churches and has not been successful in finding a church with sprinklers that is willing to allow either sanctioned camping or legal camping, I prefer to call it, or indoor warming center options.
There's got to be some place in the city or many places in the city where there can be legal camping.
Yes. So legal camping is still something that we're working on. City has land. We're working with we brought it to their attention and they will be discussing it in January with the fair board, the potential for an easement to our property adjacent to the fairgrounds. We don't have ingress and egress right now to that property, but it is adjacent to the Torres shelter. And if we were to implement sanctioned camping on that location, it's a prime location because it has has access to food that would be provided by the tourist shelter, access to transportation and grocery stores and public services. So it's an ideal location, city-owned land, so that drops our cost. And it's large enough where we could offer sanctioned camping as well as non-congregate shelter in like a phase two approach.
Susie Cockhams, when can the community expect that there will be something? I mean, what is on the horizon for you?
4 months ago, I would have said, 2 weeks ago. We are constantly riddled with barriers, whether it's service providers or money or available land or just unwilling property owners or leasing agents. The homeless population is not what real estate agents or property owners want to lease to. So that in and of itself is a challenge. I wish I had an answer for you. This is something I spend 15 hours a day working on. It's pretty much 7 days a week, but it is much bigger than the city. It is much bigger than the service providers and the county. It's all of us creating a system that works together, and we've got some weak points in the system.
Susie Cockhams, Chico Homeless Solutions Coordinator, thanks so much for your time today.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Turning now to schools during this time of rising COVID positive cases. The Chico Unified School District meets tomorrow, and the topic of school safety will certainly be on the agenda. I spoke with Chico Unified School District Board Member-elect Caitlin Dalby, the highest vote-getter in the election last month, about her ideas for keeping both students and teachers safe. I started by asking her how she is preparing to take on her new role as a school board member during a health pandemic.
That's a really funny question, because the big challenge for me right now is retooling my brain and how I think about my place in the district. Because as a teacher, we're really focused in the classroom and what's kind of right in front of us and our students and the people we work directly with, and the people at the district office are kind of over there and we're in our own little bubble. Now I'm shifting my focus to the entire district, and having to think about our elementary school teachers and our special ed teachers and our school counselors and psychologists and all the way up to administration. And so it's just really opened up my scope of who I need to be taking into consideration for everybody that's involved in doing what's best for our students and figuring out how to be the positive change agent that I've been driven to be in a much bigger way. So the way I've been preparing for that these last few weeks since the election results came out has just been to, first of all, reach out to my fellow board members to the extent possible and meet with them either on phone or, physically distanced in person, and really get to know them, because regardless of what we might think or say or exist outside of the school board meetings, we're a team and we have to be able to work together to do what's best for our staff and our students.
Well, let's talk about COVID. You have started to create a draft structure of how the school district should be addressing the pandemic. So what are some of the pieces? What is the beginning of the larger structure of how the Chico Unified School District should be addressing the pandemic?
I'm really glad you asked that. So this framework that I am drafting, I will be presenting this Friday at our school board meeting. And ideally, we'll be taking a look at it line by line, because I've really outlined the biggest issues that have come up and that have been constraints for providing the most equitable situation for all of our students. So there's been a few really big themes that have come out of this semester. One of those being that our most vulnerable students are really struggling with distance learning. And a lot of people are really quick to look at the F list and how many students have Fs, which is a concern. But also, I think that we need to remember that right now, grace needs to be given to teachers and students. And as long as our students are making connections and are having some kind of meaningful interactions and are learning something, that this year isn't a total loss. So we can't expect our students to be accelerating in all the math right now. What we need is just to make sure that our students feel successful. And so there's been some constraints in that regard with the mandates that have been given to us by the state, and then what has also come out of the district leadership for how to teach and what to teach. And so I think that a huge thing that came out of this semester was just the need to allow for more autonomy for our school site to make school site-based decisions for their student population. And so these blanket policies that we've seen coming from the school board so far this year that apply to everybody across the board doesn't fit. So part of my framework lends to our school sites is more autonomy to do what's best for their own student populations. And even at the elementary level or at the middle school level, like every single school site has slightly different needs related to their student population. So not all sites are equal. That means we need flexible guidelines for each of our school sites to operate within, because each school site has different needs and they know what those needs are. And so they will be able to come up with the best solution for their specific school site based on what guidelines we're able to provide for them.
Caitlin Dalby, do you see any untapped resources at this time, either within the school district or the wider community, that could be used for making the best of a really bad situation?
Yeah, actually, I think that the biggest untapped resources right now are our staff. I think that our staff has had so many limitations placed on them this year that we haven't got to see the largest potential of creative solutions. And so with the framework that I'm creating, it really allows for flexibility for our staff members to do what they think is going to be best for their students. At halfway through the school year as a teacher, we know which students need what support. And we know how to get those students that help that they need. So as our educators are planning for the next semester, knowing what their students need, if they're given the freedom to generate lessons with whatever resources they ask for, and they're given the time to plan, and they're given the time to collaborate and work with each other, and they're given the time to reach out to families and to work with families to come up with the best solutions for their kids, I think that we can come up with a really great program that is, you know, as individualized as we can get, given the constraints of doing some kind of in-person and remote type learning scenario. And that's so that we can also keep our families and our students and our staff safe as well. So that's really the goal, is just to allow for flexibility and autonomy for our educators to do what's going to be best and safest for them to make the decisions on how to present learning and really relationship building and connectedness with our students, and make sure that we're really reaching out to students and providing the support that they need to feel successful.
Caitlin Dalby, Chico Unified School District Board Member Elect. Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much, Sue.
Looking forward to next week. On Tuesday, December 15th, starting at 4:30 p.m., is the Oroville City Council, which meets at 1735 Montgomery Street in Oroville. Also on Tuesday, December 15th, starting at 5 p.m., the Oroville Elementary Unified School District will meet at 2795 Yard Street in Oroville. The Chico City Council also meets on Tuesday the 15th, starting at 6 p.m. at 411 Main Street in Chico. You can also watch online by going to the Chico City website. The Butte Report is made possible by the generous contributions of KZFR supporters and by Members First Credit Union, created by the community for the community. Members First is a members-owned, not-for-profit financial institution providing checking, savings, loans, and credit cards to residents of Butte, Glen, Shasta, and Tehama counties. For more information, visit m1cu.org. Remember that the most important aspect of democracy is an informed citizenry. Tune in next week and stay informed about what your local government is doing. And if you have a tip, send an email to Sue, S-U-E, at kzfr.org.
It's Thursday, time for the Chico News and Review, local news and arts from Butte County's community newspaper. on the radio.